Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's guest is, you ready for this? A humanistic psychologist exploring the depths of human potential. How's that for a great introduction? He's a psychologist. His name is Scott Barry Kaufman, his PhD, but he teaches about intelligence, creativity, and well-being at Columbia, NYU, and UPenn, which is the best of those three schools, hands down. In fact, it's completely proven, and it's also better than Harvard and Stanford, in case you guys are wondering. Anyway, I might or might not be from that same school. What he did that was really interesting and why he's on the show today is that he discovered Abraham Maslow's unfinished theory of transcendence, the one you didn't hear about. It was in unpublished journals and lectures and essays. And he said, wait a minute, I'm working on the same kind of stuff. If you guys don't know who Maslow is, he developed the hierarchy of human needs. So Scott dug into the theory and updated it with 7 decades of science that's happened since Abraham Maslow was out there. And that's what's in his new book, which is called The New Science of Self-Actualization. And the main title is Transcend. So you want to know about attachment, connection, creativity, love, and purpose? Well, it turns out there's a bit of knowledge in the interview today. Scott, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thanks for having me here.
You're also an old school podcaster like me. I mean, we go way back in the day. You've been running the psychology podcast since 2014.
Feels like an ancient podcast at this point, yeah.
And right after you launched your podcast, who was it? It was Business Insider called you one of 50 groundbreaking scientists changing the way we see the world. Did that give you a big ego?
No, I think I probably already had a big ego already.
There's nothing funnier than asking psychology people about egos, because you can see like the wheels turning. I just love doing that.
Oh, we can talk all day long about the ego and the difference between the ego and having a strong sense of self. I think, yeah, so just to answer your question, I mean, I already felt like I was pretty self-confident at that point, but it made me feel good. It definitely made me feel good.
You're also, just to fluff your ego a little bit more, you've written 9 books. Which is pretty epic, and now you're a full professor at Columbia. So you've really dug deep on the psychology side. Why do you write so many books?
I love writing. I mean, I feel like I have a writer's soul. If I had to like identify what my soul is, it feels like a writer. Like I've always enjoyed it. When I was a little kid, I used to do a lot of creative writing. I used to always imagine different worlds and things. And yeah, I enjoy it. I just really enjoy I also enjoy public science communication, and felt like writing peer-reviewed scientific papers, which I still do from time to time. But when I was really heavy in writing scientific peer-reviewed papers, and you put your heart and soul into this study, and then you write it up, and then you get all these reviews from your colleagues saying how much it sucks. And then even if it does get accepted, you wait 4 years for it to get published. By that time, you don't even care about the paper anymore. But then when it does come out, you're excited if one person reads it. So I decided, you know what? Books are a much quicker route to making an impact on the world.
I've talked to a few academics who publish professionally for everyone to read. And sometimes they get looked down on by their colleagues. Like, oh, well, you didn't do the self-flagellation academic publishing route. Like somehow you're less relevant as an academic. Did you get flack for just saying, look, I'm going to take my research directly to people who could benefit from it? Or
I did. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I was like a rebel in grad school because so Psychology Today blogs just started
right
then, 2008. And I get, you know, a call from one of the editors there. They're like, hey, you know, would you like to be one of our first bloggers? And I just, that lit me up, and I started writing blog posts about intelligence and creativity. My advisor, you know, took me aside. It was like, you know, this ain't going to get you, well, isn't, I should say, this isn't going to get you tenure. You know, this isn't going to get you tenure. You really need to rethink what you're doing with your life. And I said, I did rethink what I'm doing with my life, and I'm not going into academia.
But you did go into academia, right?
Well, you know, I never did the tenure route. So I've always, just right after grad school and from that point forward, I took off. So for instance, I ran the Imagination Institute at Penn with Martin Seligman, who is the founder of the field of positive psychology. Yeah. And I mean, that's an alternative route. Like, I wasn't actually in proper academia, you know, with like, you know, tenure track and papers. Instead, it was a lot more fun. Marty and I held all these imagination retreats, and we sought out the most imaginative minds on the planet and across these various fields, and we brought them to Penn for a weekend, and we scanned their brains, and we did all this other stuff. It's just more fun.
Yet you still succeeded academically, and you also, your area of interest, it seems like, if I was to map you out, some sort of a Venn diagram, I mean, clearly intelligence is at the beginning, but you talk about the psychology of created writing and mating intelligence. So is intelligence, creativity, or mating, like, at the center of your Venn diagram?
Well, honestly, the mating thing, that was just a phase I went through.
You got it out of your system.
Yeah, that's like, if you look at all my books and my whole body, life's work, that's the one stain on my career.
That was the outlier book, to be honest. I kind of brought that out. But you write about greatness. I mean, you're circling the realms of human performance that I'm most interested in. Yeah. Human potential. In fact, I have this thing called the Human Potential Institute. That's my coaching group with about 1,000 coaches. So human potential is at the center, and those are all in human potential.
Yeah, I think that's my thing.
What is the craziest thing that humans are capable of that people don't know about?
Don't know about? Holy cow, what a question that is. Because I people... And this may sound really banal, but I wrote once, I was writing like a tweet or something, I said, one of the most profound realizations one can have is that you can feel a certain way, and you're allowed to say, nah, I'm good. That's what the tweet said. And, you know, it's so basically the point there, it almost sounds, it's like a lot of people don't realize that they can actually divorce their mind, you know, and have a lot more psychological free will. Now, whether or not we have, you know, Big Bang level free will, that's a whole different discussion we need to do under some influences. But whether or not, you know, we have psychological free will, I think we have a lot more psychological free will than we realize. And sometimes I think it's an act of craziness to exert it.
Wow. So it's the ability to lie about our internal state to others or to ourselves?
Not to lie, but to not listen to ourselves.
To ignore ourselves.
To have that choice, at least that freedom. Sometimes we want to obviously listen to ourselves, but to have that freedom, to have that flexibility is something we often, we don't even realize we have that flexibility. Wow. Oh, you mean I didn't have to do that compulsive thing that I do every Tuesday at 4 o'clock? You know? Whoa, no, I didn't.
That's cool. That's not what I would have expected. I was hoping you were going to say levitating or something.
Oh, yeah. I almost wish I could have come on the spot with something more creative, but...
No, that's actually really... It's really perceptive, but it's because you study psychology and human potential like you do. I was also really intrigued in that you talk about the stuff that Maslow didn't finish. And he just died in the middle of it, or kind of give me a little bit of background on that.
He did die in the middle of it. And just in the past couple years of his life, he was working on a whole new theory of transcendence. He had stated at a conference, or not a conference, at a talk at a church, a Unitarian church in San Francisco. He gave this big talk, The Farther Reaches of Human Nature. I listened to the lecture recording of it. It was a very transcendent experience for me to listen to the lecture recording of it. And he says, you know, above self-actualization, once we have our basic needs met, then we can have our self-actualizing needs met. But for the very fortunate who have those needs met to a certain satisfactory degree, well, we can start to reach this level of transcendence. I don't know if you use the word level, because life is not like a video game, you know, where you get these different levels. But you know, we can harness this transcendence in our lives, and we can be motivated by, we call it, what he called the B values, the values of pure being, the values in life that you don't engage in them and you don't fuse and you're not one with them because you want something else. you're happy just in and of itself to, you know, get intrinsic joy from seeking justice in the way you get intrinsic joy from beauty, more beauty in the world, more meaning in the world, from these peak experiences, these most wondrous experiences of life that life can bring us. So yeah, he was working this whole new theory. Then he died of a heart attack at 62.
Heart attacks are really annoying.
Yeah, they suck.
I've pretty much decided that the first step to living a long time is not dying.
I think that's true. It's like
we're so profound with each other here, man.
No, well, it's funny because like sometimes like some people say things that like I think, and then you can have a debate, and there's an opinion. You know, for this one, there's no debate here. I agree.
It's funny though because some people are like, oh, I'm not going to age. You're like, you should watch your cardiovascular risk because it's that or cancer, Alzheimer's, or diabetes is going to get you if you're playing the odds. So maybe you should dodge those bullets first in your hierarchy of needs climbing. It seems like those are the low hanging fruit. So it's always really frustrating to me when one of the big four takes out a luminary, and you're like, you know, it would have not been very difficult to have avoided that. You know, it was usually bad knowledge and sometimes bad psychology that drives it. But usually people are generally doing what they think is the right thing. It's just the wrong thing. Right. And then sometimes people are self-sabotaging.
Self-sabotaging. Yeah, I think that's actually probably more common, the self-sabotaging. I think that, you know, the human will is a very fickle thing. Never quite put it that way, but it's true.
Yeah. And it's, you know, when the pizza's in front of you, like, why do I have a piece of pizza in my hand? Why is it moving towards my mouth?
Yeah.
Well, no, I'm asking you because you're a psychologist.
Oh, thanks, because I mean, pizza right now.
I wasn't gonna ask you. I just did that to you. But what is the mechanism there inside us that makes us like reach for stuff that we know at some level isn't really a good choice?
Well, you know, so humans are cybernetic systems. I'll just get really into the nerdy aspect of this. So humans are cybernetic systems, just like a thermodynamic system is a cybernetic system. There's no difference in terms of our understanding of goals and how goals work. But the interesting thing about humans is that we have evolutionary goals. And we also have goals that we set in our own lives that have no evolutionary history. And so what we have is this hodgepodge of conflicting goals going on within us. We have, if you just think about the domain of romantic relationships, it is miraculous if a marriage works. You know, you have the evolutionary evolved drives of somehow all having to come together in a harmonious way. Lust, caregiving, romantic passion. I don't know if I said, I said caregiving, romantic passion, secure attachment. All these things come apart in different ways and evolve for different reasons across the course of human evolution.
Why did you say lust three times?
Because that's more of a memory issue, not a Freudian. I know you're joking. I think if you're hinting it's a Freudian thing, I think it's actually just more just I'm getting old. My memory ain't what it used to be.
Psychology jokes.
Yeah, I love it. No, I love it. So to me, it's miraculous when you get an integrated, harmonious human, because like turtles don't have this issue, you know, like orangutans don't sit there thinking, how can I become a harmonious, integrated orangutan, you know? But for the human that can have that wisdom and foresight and consciousness to create and design a life that allows them to somehow take this hodgepodge and be a whole operating harmonious unit, I think that's miraculous, quite frankly.
It is miraculous. And the idea of, you know, evolutionary drivers ended up becoming more and more a part of my work as a biohacker over time. And I want to go through Maslow's hierarchy of needs and then how you've added transcendence on top based on his original work. And then I want to run my theory past it. And then I want you to just blow it up with a professor's ability to blow things up and tell me the holes in it or whether it matches as well as some people say, because you're a real expert on this. So walk our listeners through the basic hierarchy of needs. A lot of us remember it from seventh grade, but probably not accurately.
Traditional way it's taught is usually you see a pyramid. And at the bottom of this pyramid, at the base, I should say, you get physiological needs, food, shelter, water, important. And then right above that, are, okay, well, if we get our physiological needs met, then we can start to really focus on safety in a priority kind of way. If our safety needs are met, we feel pretty safe and secure. We have love, what Maslow called love and belonging needs, connection, intimacy with others. If that's met to a certain degree, then in terms of priority of a hierarchy, we have the need for esteem, which Maslow said is the esteem from others as well as self-esteem. So both kind of forms of esteem. And if we can have those, what he called all those things I just mentioned, basic needs, if we can have those basic needs met, then we can put our all and our entire being into the need for self-actualization, which is becoming whatever where we're most uniquely capable of becoming in life. So that's how it's traditionally presented. If you look on the internet, there are memes of it with toilet paper at the bottom, you know, during the COVID era, as the most pressing need. You also see Wi-Fi. I've seen for the past 5-6 years, I saw a lot of memes going with Wi-Fi at the bottom. You see all sorts of things. You see like the hierarchy, the Maslow's hierarchy of like constructive disagreement. And then I've seen people just use that whole framework. The fascinating thing that most people don't realize is that Maslow never drew a pyramid.
Oh, that's funny.
There's no peer. I looked through like almost every published thing, probably every published thing at Maslow ever and unpublished. And I was like, there's no, where's the pyramid? And then Todd Bridgman and his colleagues came out with this really cool paper tracing the origin of it and discovered where it actually started. The whole thing started with some management consultants in the 60s who was first a stepladder before it became a pyramid. And then in the stepladder of needs, there was the man with the top with the flagpole, you know, the self-realized man, you know, so there you go. That betrayed the spirit of Maslow, the whole pyramid. I don't think he would have liked a pyramid to represent his needs. I'd like to think how I reimagined it. My Kaufman sailboat is more in line with what Maslow's spirit of it.
What is the sailboat? How does that work?
I did just beg that question, didn't I? Well, so Did you want to pick up what I just threw down there? But, you know, Maslow's sailboat, you know, you have, Kaufman's sailboat. My sailboat.
There you go there.
There we go. Well, I created the sailboat. But here's why I think it's a better depiction of the spirit of Maslow. I did want to give my brother man, Abraham Maslow, some credit. I wanted to restore the whole vision he had for human development. So human development, I think, is more of like a experience through the vast unknown. We never know when the storm is going to come, when the waves are going to come crashing down on us. But we need at least to have no holes in our boat. So we need to have a secure, firm boat with our basic needs met. To a certain degree, we don't have severe holes, deficiencies, where we're motivated by the deficiencies. But once our boat is secure, we still aren't going anywhere unless we open up the sail and we're vulnerable to the winds. You know, we're vulnerable to just the unknown of life. You know, we still go in our most purposeful direction with a spirit of exploration and love. You know, not knowing at any time when that wave may come crashing down, not on us, but all the boats that were all going in their own purposeful direction at the same time. Now, all of a sudden, we realize we're all in the same sea together, you know. So I think the metaphor of the sailboat works better and allows us to talk more about the dialectical between security and growth or defense and growth. More so than get so stuck on this precise ordering of needs like as depicted in the pyramid. What do you think? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Do you have to be vulnerable to grow?
Oh, well, now that's a whole topic that I just am obsessed with lately. I can't believe you just asked me that. It's like,
well, I mean, you said that in your words, kind of.
Yeah.
But it feels like you can grow if all you are is defending, but you just like grow bigger walls. So vulnerability is a really big thing. I had to learn how to consciously be vulnerable so I could be who I am today.
Oh, this is on my mind so much right now. I just can't believe that is the sliver of what I said that you picked up on. You're an astute human.
Thank you.
So I think there's become a cult of vulnerability, quite frankly. And I've been willing to push back on it lately because as I go in great detail in my book on the self-esteem chapter, there's a thing that I've been studying lately called vulnerable narcissism. No. Yeah. It's I've published papers on this topic.
Vulnerability signaling. It's like virtue signaling. Is that what we're saying here?
What it is it's, you know, you think because you've suffered that you're entitled. It's entitlement because you've suffered as opposed to entitlement because you think you're great. So grandiose narcissism is the kind that has you normally think of when you think narcissism. You think
like chest, for politics,
chest thumping, you know, like I'm great, you know, therefore I'm entitled to all special privileges because I'm the best. But right. We've studied this really interesting, not as well known version flavor. It's a more introverted flavor of narcissism, a more vulnerable form where, you know, that's the kind of person that they lay in their bed all day. And why is that person succeeding and I'm not? You know, there's a lot of resentment, you know.
It's the victim mindset. Basically.
Yeah.
You know, I'm entitled because I'm a victim.
Okay. Yeah, basically.
Is that the same kind of thing? Okay.
Yeah.
But I like that you're putting in the, because I've been vulnerable, because I've been harmed, therefore, you know, I deserve this. Wow, I never thought of it as being a form of narcissism, but it's totally obvious when you said that. Wow.
Yeah, I'm working on that might be my next book, actually. Yeah, I'm just like fascinated with this topic.
Please write that book. That is something cool. That needs to exist because awesome. I have seen that now because I get to work with, you know, a lot of people in my different companies. And yeah, there's a certain mindset sometimes. And it is, they behave exactly like narcissists, like without self-awareness. When you're stuck in that loop, exactly the same as someone who's like, I'm the world's best, which is why I can't see my own mistakes. Right.
Exactly.
Wow.
It's self-absorption.
I can't wait to read that book.
Yeah. Wow. Cool, man. Cool. Well, I would be honored to come back to talk to you at any point about that in the future. But sure. Yeah, no, it's a fascinating, this whole idea, you know, because I used to be fully on the Brené Brown train. You know, I was like, vulnerability, yes, like sensitivity. And I wrote books on this, you know, my book Wired to Create was all about how sensitivity and creativity are linked. But then I think what happens with these kind of things is the pendulum can swing too much in a particular direction where suddenly you're like shamed if you're not being vulnerable, you know?
Yeah.
And if you say anything like, no, actually I feel pretty confident, like you're viewed as evil.
Yeah, you know, entitled or something, right?
There's something where things have flipped around where we don't empower people to want to be have agency now. We empower people to be a victim.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. I'm seeing it as a major trend. Yeah. And the bottom line is the people I've come to respect the most, having interviewed, we're pushing almost 1,000 coming up here this year. Mm. The people who have like suffered greatly and learned and stepped out of it and become leaders. In fact, it's one of the things I studied in one of my books about 500 people been on the show to find the commonalities of the things that they thought were most important. And yeah, it's that, okay, a lot of them really went through near-death experiences, you know, great trauma and shame and whatever else in their life, and then picked themselves up, worked their asses off, learned, and don't identify with that as in, it's something that happened. And it almost feels like that mindset is out of vogue right now.
It's very out of vogue. And we don't need to go into great detail about this, but I mean, I have a story. I was in special education as a kid. So like this, all these accolades and things you mentioned about me were not, no one predicted it. Where the heck did that come from?
Were you in the gifted program or the other side of it?
No, the opposite.
Okay.
Yeah, because I had an auditory disability. It was hard for me to process things in real time when I was young.
I had one of those too, by the way, auditory processing.
Yeah, I'm like, high five.
Yeah, exactly.
I had central auditory processing disorder is the official name of what I had. And it took me a couple extra milliseconds to just process in real time. So they thought I was stupid. And for a while, I kept that as the core to my identity. So that was like, you know, I'm Scott, and I was in special as a child. I would tell that story, you know, every keynote speech I would give, that's my big story, you know, like, and I want to tell everyone how I was in special ed. And then there became a point in the past couple years where I started to rethink all of this, and I started to rethink narratives. I started to rethink the arc of my life and realize that I just don't want to keep telling that story anymore. You know, for lots of reasons, I'd rather lead with who I am today. you know, and it almost didn't dawn on me for many years. You mean I'm allowed to lead with what I'm doing, who I am right now, you know? And it was a realization for me that it was mind blowing.
You do have some pretty impressive credentials, to be honest. I mean, you look at all the different stuff you've worked on, different things. So you can totally lead with that. And there you go. You know, you're an author and a teacher and professor, and there's that. They do say, though, that people who choose to study psychology usually are trying to deal with their own problems first, right?
Yeah. Wait, who says that? I never heard that before.
Everyone who's ever talked to a psychologist.
They say, is this what you think, Dave?
No, I've had many psychologists that I've gone to see tell me that. So,
what do they say? Research is me search. I know, you know, people say all the time. That's what did spur me to want to study intelligence. And that was my original topic that I studied in my field was intelligence, when, you know, like IQ testing and all that. And that definitely was me search. And then I started to identify some aspects of vulnerable narcissism in my 20s. I think, wow, in my 20s, I was really vulnerably narcissistic. Holy cow. And, you know, just realizing some of this stuff has been just so eye-opening for me. And I kind of want to, I really want to help others, like identify the same patterns. I think in the self-help world, and I'd love to get your thoughts about this, in the self-help world, there's so much of, like, you are a badass, like you're great, you know, don't listen to anyone, don't listen to haters, you're amazing. And there's not as much like, identify the narcissistic characteristics within yourself. Identify the different ways you're self-sabotaging yourself and how your self-hate and pity, instead of being reframed as you're awesome, might actually be hindering your growth ultimately. Okay. Like, do you know what I mean?
I dare you to name your next book, What If You Actually Suck?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying is, like, I would love to do that.
That's a great title for a book.
Like, what if
Jensen Sarah would probably come up and kick your ass? She's the author of You're a Badass.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. And I don't mean to target anyone in particular.
Your point is that the rah-rah, I've seen this too, even in the kind of in the empowerment movement. It's like, and I'm not calling any particular friend out on this, but it's like, oh, we're going to teach you, you know, to be an expert in something or to be an influencer. And it's like, well, step one, acquire something worthy of sharing that you can use with your influence, right? And it's, if you're going after fame because you're supposed to, or you think it's a way to make money, fame sucks. It actually is a huge amount of work.
More emails,
more all kinds of pressures. And yeah, you can use it to do good. But if you're just going after it just because you want to feel good about yourself, like, trust me, just go to a therapist. It's way less work than trying to get well known. It's not worth it.
It's so true. I really like you, man. I really like you. This is the first time I've ever talked to you. So I feel like I like your vibe for whatever that's worth. I'm just thinking because a lot of people who want to be famous, there's a fascinating phenomenon that happens. That's not really what they wanted. There was another need that was unfulfilled, but they thought that would fulfill what they really wanted. And then when they eventually get what they really want, they fall in love, for instance, or they find someone who they have an intimate connection with, or what other deeply unfulfilled need is really meant, they suddenly don't care as much about the fame. I think that's so interesting, such an interesting phenomenon. Yeah, I mean, in my book, I lay out these principles of why we should strive for growth, not happiness, you know, or strive for meaning. So meaning and happiness are two different dissociable things in the psychological literature. And all the research I've seen shows that happiness comes for the ride of meaning. It's like an epiphenomenon, whereas you can be happy in the sense like you report high life satisfaction or you have positive emotions, but feel spiritually empty, feel deeply unfulfilled. That's why I'm really interested in basic needs and need and whole self fulfillment.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chilligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chilligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Do you think we're going to get to the point where we can just have a survey and like you fill out these 100 questions and we're going to be able to exactly know where in, you know, Kaufman's sailboat of needs you're lacking, and which, you know, which sail needs more rigging or whatever the right analogy is? I mean, are we going to be able to quantify this and be like, oh, you're missing meaning in your life, so, you know, take this, you know, take this drug and it'll tell you your purpose in life, and, you know, like, can we patch the holes, identify the weaknesses?
Well, I do have a test, free test you could take right now and find out your self-actualization score.
All right. Tell me, where do I go? I'm
Selfactualizationtest.com.
Who would have thought? What a creative URL.
I mean, to respond to that, I can be like, well, you can actually take the test.
That is a pretty, we're having trouble finding that site.
Okay, selfactualizationtests.com.
With an S.
Let's try that. I'm trying this in real time with you. Yes, with an S. And the first one, characteristics of self-actualization scale.
Oh, it's got a picture of an orange flower. All right, orange is a good color. So, okay, so you actually go down there somewhere on that web.
So we can discuss the various tests that lie
here. Oh, I
see.
All of those are ones that you actually let people do right there?
Yes, I created all these tests. And so I created the dark side of the force. It actually can quantify whether or not you're in the light or the dark side of the force. From the Star Wars metaphor, but actually scientifically validated the light versus dark triad scale. So you can, that might actually be more interesting to you.
You're the biggest nerd ever.
Oh, yeah. I just wrote an article for Scientific American on that. The Science of Nerdiness is the title of it.
Can you read my coffee mug?
Come to the nerd side. Oh, my God. I love it. Oh, my God. Can I take a picture?
Sure. My mug says, come to the nerd side. We have pie, and it's the character for pie.
That is amazing.
That just happened to be on my desk.
I need to get that mug. I need to get that mug. No, I want to empower people to embrace their nerdy side. And I think that I actually think that there's like a stigma against it. When you try to have like intellectual discussion, like people are like, I feel like you're wrong. And then you're like, well, can we discuss it from like a high level intellectual, you know, point of view? And then they're like, you're evil. It's like, wait, what?
You're all, no, I'm not, because I took this card. Okay, so are you on the dark side or the light side according to your own research?
No, I'm pretty high on the light triad, because the facets of the light triad are things like faith in humanity. I'm a humanistic psychologist. Hypocritical if I wasn't on the light side.
But I love humanism, but most people don't know what it is. What is humanism?
Yeah. Well, so here's something else. I think humanistic psychology is not the same thing as humanism.
Ooh.
Humanism, you know, could be considered a whole school of philosophical thought, but I'm talking about humanistic psychology, which has as its goal the understanding of the whole human and how we, what it means to live an experientially alive life, one that's full of meaning, purpose, and connection with others, and to kind of feel like you're at your full potential as a human, you know, you're fully human. To me, that's what I mean by I'm a humanistic psychologist. And also, you tend to have a positive view of humanity. You recognize that humans are flawed beings, but you recognize you're a flawed being too, and you know you're really interested more in what unites us than divides us. So that's what I mean by humanistic psychology. But yeah, humanism, I'm on board with humanism as well, which is more about, you know, rational thought, and but it's not exactly the same thing. You know, it's appreciation of science, appreciation of I don't know, have you read Steven Pinker's book, The End of Enlightenment?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm definitely on board with a lot of those things, and I think there's a lot of overlap for sure. But yeah,
have you shifted your view on, you know, the world's a friendly, happy, nice place recently, given the shit show that 2020 has been?
I really have, and it's so funny because it's such a great question. It's such a great question because I have days where I am like, you know what, I just want to like just impulsively tweet. you know what? I've changed my mind. Humans suck.
Have you changed your mind that much?
But I haven't. Here's the thing. I'm saying I have my days. I have my moments because I'm human. But then, you know, this is why I haven't tweeted that, because I don't believe that to be true. I believe part of being human is having our moments, for sure. But I think I maintain my faith in humans because I'm constantly reminded of the goodness of humans when I look for it. And I think that's the point. The point is, or when I'm not trying to bring out the worst. And so it's very easy to see the worst in humans when you do all the things to activate someone's defense mechanisms. But it's also very easy to see the goodness in humans when you just truly listen to someone and you're just truly present with another person to admire them for who they are on their own terms, not what you can get out of them. Then you start to have a little more faith in humanity. So that's why. So yes, I definitely, let's put it this way. This moment has made me have more of my moments, but does that make sense? But I still maintain my faith in humanity.
Okay. So you've managed to maintain it. I've definitely gone through some stuff over the last couple of years where I'm like, I can't believe that anyone would do something that incredibly douchey. Like, but then for me, the escape valve there is when I look really at the psychology of it, what people tend to do is they tend to be so unwilling to face the reality of what they're doing or what they've created that they just make up a fake world where they didn't do that. And then they proceed as if that's the world that they're living in, and they're just unable to see that reality. And then you realize I'm probably not gonna be able to pierce that reality bubble. And if I do, they're just gonna feel pain. And there's kind of nothing left to be done there. So that's kind of my true. People are basically good. If only they would see reality, they'd probably behave differently. How do you handle situations like that?
So, so true. How do I handle situations within myself when that arises?
Yeah, or how does one do it? But I'm assuming that you've studied this more than the average bear. So,
I mean, I don't have any secret of the universe to tell you in response to that. But I do think that there are so many ways we delude ourselves and ways that we erect our defense mechanisms and these mechanisms served us when we were young because we couldn't even imagine the unbearable pain that would happen if we were rejected by that girl, you know. I don't know why that example come up, but that's a joke. But when we're young, you know, there's all sorts of ways, you know, which we erect these defenses. But when we become older, we need to shed them. You know, we need to be grounded in reality as firmly as possible if we're ever going to grow. And I'm a big believer of that. I'm a big believer of that when it comes to social movements. I've been trying to advocate the value of science. There's some activists and they'll say things and I'll be like, well, I don't think that's scientifically true what you're saying. Maybe your activism would actually be more valuable if you build it on a solid foundation of reality, you know? So things like that, I think that it's really important to confront reality in order to change or acceptance.
Okay. That makes good sense. I still don't know that I have the entire coping mechanism in place for when people, you know, completely are just living in a false reality. And you're like, wait a minute, you say one thing, you believe what you're saying, but it doesn't match the numbers. And when that kind of thing happens, it feels, you know, I've been talking with a bunch of other entrepreneurs about it. And you're like, wait a minute, it takes a while because people like that, I don't think they're intentionally deceitful, but they tend to be very hard to spot. Are there tricks to find when you're dealing with people like that?
I think they're easy to spot. You think they're hard to spot?
Well, when they're easy to spot, you know, after 3 months of looking at results from people like that. But someone, you know, who walks in and says, I'm great at what I do.
I see what you're saying. And in a lot of ways, you're asking, how do you spot a grandiose narcissist?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's my question to a T.
It's funny. I wrote a whole article. Do you know who Tucker Max is?
Yeah, he's a friend. He's also an odd and funny guy. Yeah.
So I would say at one point we were friends. We just got out of touch. But yeah, like about 9 years ago or so, I was writing a cover story for Psychology Today. It was called How to Spot a Narcissist. And he was my main material. Like basically I called him up and I was like, how do I spot a narcissist? And so he gave me lots of he's a very brilliant, very smart guy. Yes. So he gave me he reverse engineered the narcissist, and so it was like really interesting to kind of write a lot of this stuff down. And I think that you can in a lot of subtle ways, and you realize that there's like that reality distortion machine that people talked about with Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
You know, you can start to pick up on that. You know, you can look at a history. I assume if you're doing hiring, you're going to look at a person's resume and be like, how many sort of failed experiments were there? How many how many times did like an idea start and then it like immediately flopped, you know? Almost everything will eventually flop. That's a whole other story, but immediately flopping, you know?
Right.
So I don't know. I think there are lots of ways of spotting it, and also spotting it within ourselves. I think it's a continuum. I don't believe in a world where there are narcissists and there are not narcissists. You know, we all have these tendencies within ourselves, and we often don't see them within our own self. We're often deluding ourselves.
So as we were talking, I have the ability to listen and type and stuff. I just took my light dark and it says I'm Yoda. Is that?
You were taking that test this whole time?
Yeah. And I was listening to everything you said.
That's amazing. So yes, Yoda is you're on the light side.
No, Yoda was an answer. I'm actually intrigued because it says I'm 20% better on faith in humanity than average or higher than average.
Yeah.
I'm good. Totally average on humanism. Mm-hmm. I'm totally average on Kantianism. But on the dark side, it says I'm 12.45% more narcissistic than the average.
Yeah. No, that's great. And then what are the other two?
I'm a little bit less psychopathic than the average.
Yeah.
And I'm 20% more Machiavellian, which totally surprises me.
Yeah, makes complete sense. No, this makes complete... How do you get to where you are today with like not at least like 10 to 20% higher narcissism and Machiavellianism? I think there's huge strengths in your specific case. I really do think you have to view these things in the whole context of the rest of the personality structure. So sure. I want to understand you as a whole, you know, and your whole personality structure.
Well, I'll take the rest of the test on there. That's only one of them.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because way back in my career, I was in my mid-20s and suddenly I'm attending senior executive leadership meetings and board meetings for a publicly traded company. And I'm generally not allowed to speak, but you know, I'm watching all this and I came out of there just shaking my head going, these people are batshit crazy. Like nothing they do makes sense. Like I'm an engineer, I'm a nerd, I know how stuff works and what they're doing is pathological. And then I read 48 Laws of Power, Robert Greene's book. And I was like, oh my God, it like opened my eyes because they were playing by a set of hidden world stuff that I didn't know how to see. And I learned how to see it from Robert Greene, and he's been on the show and I've thanked him. But was really the first time I ever realized how Machiavellian people were being towards me.
Yeah.
Even in a setting like that. And I think I developed some defenses, but it does surprise me that it thinks I'm more Machiavellian than average, but not particularly high either. So,
well, if this makes you feel any better, the average score is low. So it doesn't even mean you're higher than 50%. You need to think about this properly. It doesn't mean you're high in Machiavellianism. You know what I mean? That's not what that score means. Yeah. It's like if the average is like 2 and you're like 2.4, you're still low Machiavellianism.
Okay. I've already planned my next whole keynote speech thing. It's going to be like, I thought I was a good person and then I did this coffin sailboat test thing and now it wounded my soul and now I'm entitled to be treated with extra respect. I thank you, man. You've empowered me.
I've empowered you for special privileges. That's hilarious. Because you found out you're entitled, because you found out your narcissism scores high. Well, you know, you got the Yoda. Look, like, it's amazing. It's the psychology of you and what you focused on with that test result. Yoda is what you got. So Yoda does is assesses the totality of your wholeness and then gives you the result, which is what I did, not one specific facet of you.
Wow. That was a massive piece of psychological ninjury. Ninja-ery?
I like it.
Well, tell me more about Maslow and his hierarchy of needs. Yeah. So you talked about the main one, but what about the transcendent part of it? Give that to me in a nutshell. I'm really intrigued at that.
He had this theory Z. So McGregor, Douglas McGregor, was an organizational psychologist in like the 60s, 70s, argued that there's a theory X and theory Y that manage. This was a management theory that managers who hold a theory X in their workplace tend to be very carrot stick, you know, reward oriented. Those who hold a theory Y idea in the workplace, workers are motivated intrinsically. They just enjoy what they're doing. Right. But Maslow's like, I think there's a theory Z, something higher where you don't. And then he distinguished between non-transcending self-actualizers and transcending self-actualizers. He called them the transcenders. And he looked at the characteristics of the transcenders. And he's like, you know what? You can be self-actualized. You can be a non-transcending self-actualizer. You can go to your 9-to-5 job. You can be, you're a great coder. You know, like you have your work day and you figured out all the bugs in the code and you go home and go to sleep. You know, I don't know. That was probably a terrible example. And I just upset and pissed off coders for not including them in the class of transcending self-actualizers. But the point I'm trying to make here before I get in trouble.
Only the ones who do LSD when they code, then they're different.
If you do the LSD while you're coding, now you're a transcender. Yes.
There you go.
That's right. The difference between non-self-actualized transcenders is, you know, you enjoy your job, you know, you feel good about it, and you feel like you're fulfilling your potential, but you just don't care at all about helping to fulfill the potential of society. You know,
There's a tribe of people out there, and I know because I'm one of them, and I connect with others like that who actually give a lot of shits about that. Like that's a focus for them. And there's other people, it's just not what they're here to do.
They're not.
Like, yeah. I never thought of it that way. But you kind of shined a flashlight on that for me. That's cool.
Well, Matt, I want to give all the credit to Maslow for that. He blew my mind when I read I literally read it in his journal articles. This is stuff that wasn't even published. He has a journal entry. I read this two-volume set. You can buy it on Amazon, but I think I'm the only one who ever bought it anywhere. But I read it. Two-volume, 2000 his personal diaries, and there's one entry, you know, in the middle of it where he says, "New insight today. I think there's two types of self-actualized." I was like, "Holy shit!"
Wow, just buried in there. And
yeah, I was like, "This is good shit." Is anyone else seeing this?
Well, it's actually a really powerful technique to like, let's go back to what our elders learned and learn from them. And there's just so much there that we can pick up and kind of stand on the shoulders of giants. I mean, a lot of the biohacking stuff, especially get into the weird states. Like, oh, yeah, they knew about that in the 13th century from meditating in caves for a while. Mm. And probably the guy who's most an example of that is Dan Brown, where, you know, basically the father of attachment theory, but also, oh, yeah, let me go translate this Sanskrit text in the same human being. Like, that just blew my mind when I got to talk to him. But you also talk about attachment in your book. What is the role of attachment and other things there when it comes to this new transcending level of Maslow's hierarchy?
Sure. Attachment, I put in the boat itself. It's not part of the sail. It's part of our security. You know, it's part of our grounding. We feel like we have a safe base that we can return to in times of need and that we trust that safe base. So if our attachment style is insecure, we don't trust our protectors very much, you know? And so I think we can be insecurely attached to our environment, not just our caregivers like, you know, parents, but I also think we can live in a very distrustful environment where, you know, we don't trust anybody, you know, around us. We're cynical about everything. Now, what I'm really fearing is that this is what America's become, but that's a whole other conversation. But
become cynical, you're saying?
Yeah, that we've become a nation of, we're all distrustful, you know, with each other. We think everyone has an ulterior motive or a different intention, you know. Now everything, you know, is virtue signaling, you know, everything has some sort of like, you know, alternative, more nefarious reason than what people are doing. And I think that that's very interesting to me. And I think that it's almost the same analogy. We don't trust our protector, you know, like our president of the United States. You know, we don't really tend to feel as though, or just the virus. You know, we could just go to the virus level if you don't want to go to the more controversial political level. But, you know, we're very fearful now of.
I'm wondering how the virus is going to vote, so I know that I should trust it or not.
Yeah.
I don't know how you can politicize a virus or something like that.
That's why I was like, stick to the virus, Scott. Stick to the virus, Scott. I don't want to piss off the Trump supporters. But I feel like a lot of people in this country, it's a fact. I think it's a fact, whether or not you are whatever you're a fan of politically. You know, there's a lot of distrust in our leaders right now.
Yeah. How would someone listening to this who's just feeling triggered as all hell, they're triggered if they see someone driving with or without a mask in a car, okay, because both sides of that are triggering, or triggered around politics. I mean, it's election time and all that. Is there a way to turn off the triggering so you can take a deep breath and look at the facts and just like not be emotional about it?
That's a tricky one, my friend, because I'm going to do one of these on the one hand, on the other hand, then on the fourth hand. You know, like this is how I feel about that question. On the one hand, the caring hat that thinks, you know, I don't want to ever get to the point where I'm no longer emotionally affected by real injustices in the world. Like, I never want to become the person who no longer feels or cares about the suffering of others. Okay, so that's the one hand. There's another hand that says, well, while we can hold that to be true, I think we can also hold to be true at the same time that I also don't want to be the one that's ruled by those feelings. I don't want to be the type of person that has no choice at all in whether or not I let that affect me and cloud my seeing of reality. So I think that we just need to not go so much in the opposite direction where we no longer are outraged by anything that is important to be outraged, because as Eric Fromm, the humanistic psychologist, said, to be seen in an insane society is the highest marker of insanity. So I don't ever want to go there. But at the same time, I do think with meditation practices, with certain spiritual practices of even just philosophy, like I'm very into Buddhist philosophy, and the notion of non-attachment in Buddhist philosophy is actually very much in line with secure attachment in the psychological literature. So that's an interesting connection. But
wow, that's actually some profound stuff right there. Because so non-attachment equals secure attachment.
Yeah, the way Buddhist. I'm very into Buddhist philosophy.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I get the sense you are too, by the way. But just the whole notion of non-attachment is really about being so secure in yourself and in the world that you aren't so influenced. You do have the separation between stimulus and response, you know, that you're not so reactive and anxious and fearful about everything.
To get to that state, do you need to be kind of high up Maslow's hierarchy? Like I'm safe, I'm secure, I have enough food, I have enough money, no one's going to break down my door
in order to
be non-attached? No,
absolutely not. But by the way, I thought you were going to just stop with after high, the word high. do you need to be high?
I thought your answer was going to be cannabis to that question about what does it take to be non-reactive.
Because I was going to answer, I mean, I would have answered that if you just stopped and put a period after the word high. But I think that that's a myth. Because I do get sometimes from various people who are well-meaning, you know, they're very into the social justice world and they're fighting good causes, but they'll say things like, you know, Scott, you can't even begin to study what you're studying until we've cured everything in the world. You know, all discrimination is gone. And the thing is, I think it's a false dichotomy.
That's just a state of helplessness.
Yeah. I agree.
The same thing people saying, well, you can't think about moving to a moon colony or to Mars or something until you fix everything on the planet.
Fix everything on the planet,
When someone hits that point of transcendence that was, you know, Maslow's hidden, hidden or unfinished work, how different from enlightenment is that? the Buddhist concept of enlightenment.
Yeah, I mean, I have a in my chapter on transcendence, on certain peak, I think it's called peak experiences, I have a whole chart I try to amass throughout the ages, different terms and labels that different philosophical systems have used to talk about the same darn thing. I think it's the same thing. I mean, what Maslow was talking about, trying to get to in this his theory Z worldview, you know, there's a whole theory Z worldview of wisdom and insight and into the human condition and into oneself, I think is very much in line with 78 other terms that that people have used. Some terms that were, I never heard of them before, like love-fire. Have you heard of that?
Is it, no. Where's
transcendence?
That from?
I don't know.
Like Jim
I don't
Jones
know
where. Or something.
I'd have those to look up the source.
That was really dark.
You're funny. I'd have to look up the source, but there are all sorts of labels and terms and things like I never heard of that one for that. But I think that there's a minimum number of actual phenomena underlining a massive amount of different words and labels, and you know, and every now and then you'll get some person who's a good marketer will come up with their own new term for something, which is the same darn phenomenon as has been studied for millions of years. But this amazing marketer is able to put some word on it, you know, that like, people are like, oh, that's Sofukabuku. He's right. You know, and it's like, nah, actually a lot of other people have talked about that, but yeah.
Personal development, pretty much everything that's said by modern, you know, just epic personal development people pretty much exists in some 14th century text somewhere on the planet. Like, we've been studying this for a long time. We just keep forgetting that we've been studying it.
It's true. That's why I think it's so important to the wisdom of our elders. You know, like this book, I couldn't have done it without Maslow, and I consider him a dear friend I'd never met.
Yeah. I you know what I hear in that is, okay, I'm just blanking on his name. Napoleon Hill. You know, Think and Grow Rich. He talks about cultivating a mastermind, not the kind of mastermind that we're all members of these days, but a virtual mastermind in his head. So he'd sit and he'd recreate Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin and whoever his other heroes were, and to the point they almost became real, and he'd have conversations and ask them what they'd think and taught people how to do that. So, you know, you've instantiated, you've created a virtual machine of a Maslow in your head that you can consult, it sounds like, which is kind of cool.
I really did. I feel like I know exactly what he would say about everything.
Yeah, well, you set him to that level, which is actually in and of itself a pretty unique thing to do. It's cool.
If I was that good at, yeah, sorry, go on. If I was that good at, like, you know, stalking in real life, you know, but I'm not. Calm down.
Yeah, it's a lot of work to stalk in real life. You have to go places and take pictures and stuff.
Thanks for taking that as a joke.
Now, in your book, you talk about practical tips for how to use the knowledge, which also I really appreciate as a fellow author. You know, taking the academics and saying, now, here's what to do is a great act of service for readers. And I want you to share in this interview some of the practical tips, some of the exercises they have in the book that you think are most useful.
Yeah, we have a whole set of growth challenges. Actually, I put up an online course I'm doing surrounding the book where we have people really go through these exercises and discuss them with each other and what it was like for them. I call them growth challenges. These aren't things that are necessarily going to make you happy. Again, we're going to go through the difference between happiness and growth, you know, but they're things that will help you grow. They really will, and they'll help you get outside your comfort zone. So exploring your dark side is a really important one, you know, where you really sit with your whole being and try to even think about, well, how can I reframe this artificial distinction between positive and negative emotions? Like, maybe we just have comfortable and uncomfortable emotions. You know, could these uncomfortable emotions serve my growth? You know, and in what ways could they? You know, there's a whole sort of growth challenges to help you make connections and have high quality connections with others. There's different listening techniques. There's something called active constructive responding technique. There are actually things you can learn to be a darn good listener. Carl Rogers, the humanistic psychotherapist, called it active listening. Asking good follow-up questions and really showing that you comprehend what the other person's saying. You're quite good at that, for what it's worth.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's a lot of growth challenges, you know, trying to seek out and live, just live and try to live more in the be realm of human existence. Maslow called the being realm, where you seek out the beauty, you seek out the meaning. You actually, sometimes you have to, you can't just accept and just assume that, oh, well, my life sucks, so therefore it will, everything sucks here around me, and there's no point in having agency. Don't ever lose that. There's no point in having agency. Don't lose that. Try to seek out the B realm as much as you can. You know, try to, if it's going on a virtual, you know, you're feeling down, you're like, I need beauty in my life right now. Try to seek out, like, hopefully if you have a computer, you know, a virtual tour, you know, of a museum or something, you know, or go out in nature as much as you can. Or if you have a friend who's always nagging, you know, be like, look, I love you, but I need a pause here, and then call up your friend who makes you come alive.
Thank you for writing a cool book, actually writing a whole bunch of cool books. I'm going to have to do all your other online tests so I can be more judgmental of myself. I'm really looking forward to all of the self-flagellation that will follow. It's going to make me a better person. I know it.
I expect good results. I'm being more positive here.
I'm just messing with you.
I know you are. I know.
I actually really think that there's great
value. But I'm literal. So
you're literal.
Yeah.
There's great value. And we should actually name that URL again. I have it in one of these windows here. It's your main website is scottbarrykaufman.com, and it's on there, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Everything's there. Yep.
And the name of your book is Transcend. And this would have been a longer interview. It's been a lot of fun for me. Hopefully it was fascinating for all of our listeners. If you guys like this, there's stuff in Scott's book that is not commonplace and worthy of consideration. So this is a book that's actionable, but it's also just an interesting read to just think about it. So thanks for taking the time to write it.
Thank you so much for saying that and for having me on the show. It's so much fun talking to you.
If you guys like the show, you know what to do. Read the book. And if you're ordering that book and you happened to go to fastthisway.com or order my new book, Fast This Way, that's not even out yet, then what'll happen is every time people order Fast This Way, they'll see Scott's awesome book shown up right next to on Amazon. Wow. And as always, if you read a book, you are required by state law now to actually leave a review for the author. Because if don't leave a review for the author, you're a bad person and you're 100% narcissist, Machiavellian, evil person on the scale. Am I right, Scott?
Yeah, it has to be 5 stars, though. That's the rule.
Oh, of course. Stars. And a 5-star review, of course, of course. All right, guys, I'll see you on the next episode.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.